Interlude. Holes. Addiction is like the Joker. It just wants to see the whole world burn. Chapter 6. Bruce Willis. After 3 long months of rehab, I was feeling better. Back on my feet, I was very excited to live a life that was not completely ruled by alcoholism and addiction. I had stopped drinking and drugging, and my cravings for each had disappeared. Something way, way bigger than me was in charge now. Miracles do happen. The first move I made was driving to Jamie Tarsus's house. "I need to process being sober," I said to her, "and that's going to take up all my time. I'm incredibly grateful for all the wonderful things you did for me." I could see her face losing color. "But I can't be in a relationship right now," I said. So, to be clear, in order to adequately pay sweet, wonderful Jamie back for 2 years of giving up huge portions of her own very busy, important life by basically being my nurse, I ended our relationship. Jamie Tarsus was one of the most magical, beautiful, smart, oh, so smart. I love the way her mind worked. And I broke up with her, proving that getting sober didn't make me any smarter. In fact, it may have made me a colossal idiot. Jamie was probably the most amazing person I had ever met, and she loved me. But I wasn't ready for that. What I said to Jamie that day was all bullshit, of course. I was newly sober, a huge star, and I wanted to sleep with every single girl in Southern California. And I did. Insert cartoon anvil landing on my head here. Because of this huge star thing, I had no problem getting dates, and this is how I opened each and every one of them. "Hi. Sorry I'm late. You look great, by the way. I've been really excited to finally meet you." Pause for appropriate positive response. "But I don't want to get off on the wrong foot here," I would continue. "I want to be as transparent as possible. I'm an open book. Ask me anything. I'll tell you the truth." More warmth would be shared. On a good day, she would tend to be nodding along, loving my transparency, my emotional pitch, my very air of suave involvement. Then I'd bring the hammer down. "I'm not sure what you're looking for, but if it's any kind of emotional attachment, I'm not your man." Pause to let this sink in. "I'm not going to call you every day," I went on, "and I'm not going to be your boyfriend, but if it's fun you're looking for, I am your man." That great 20th century philosopher Cyndi Lauper was right, as it turned out. Girls do, in fact, just want to have fun. But in case the message wasn't entirely clear, I added some salt to the heady stew I was ladling out. "I'm an extremely passionate person," I said a little abashedly, in case they thought I protest too much. "In fact, I'm a bit of a romantic. Even beating up the elliptical machine, all I do is listen to songs about women in some kind of duress. But I'm not looking for or available for any kind of emotional relationship." I repeated, just in case the message had been a tad fuzzy. "I just got out of a long-term relationship, and I had just gotten sober, and I'm not looking to be in one now." And then it was time to nail the landing. "Oh, did you want to look at the menu?" I'd say. "I hear the food here is fantastic." It is amazing how many women signed up for this after all that. I presume many of them thought they could change me. "What's that you say?" "Oh, yes, I did get the occasional abrupt walkout, of course. A few women would say, well, I'm not interested in that at all, and would just get up and leave. No surprise that those were the ones that I was really interested in." But for the most part, my speech worked to a T. I use the word "worked" loosely, because I barely need to point out that the best you could say about all of this was that at any point you could exchange my head for a donkey's ass and no one would see the difference. Not only had I just broken up with the greatest woman on the planet, What I was proposing was just a fucking waste of time. Sex is great and everything, but I think I would be a much more fulfilled person now if I had spent those years looking for something more. In a life riddled with mistakes, this may have been my biggest one, and mistakes are hard to undo. During that time, I met at least 5 women that I could have married and had children with. Had I done so just once, I would not now be sitting in a huge house overlooking the ocean with no one to share it with, save a sober companion, a nurse, and a gardener twice a week. A gardener I would often run outside and give $100 to so he'd turn his fucking leaf blower off. We can put a man on the moon, but we can't invent a silent one of those things? Natasha Wagner was one of these women. Not only is she beautiful, smart, caring, and sexy, she's also the daughter of Natalie Wood and Richard Gregson, and raised by Robert Wagner and then by Robert Wagner and Jill St. John after her mother's tragic death. Natasha had it all. She was perfect. But I wasn't looking for perfect. I was looking for more, 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 more. So, because I'd done the speech at her and then not properly dated her, we parted ways. And I was left to find even more perfect women when, in fact, I'd already found them. A few years later, I was driving on the Pacific Coast Highway one day in some kind of fuck-off-everybody car, a car so amazing that I now cannot for the life of me remember what it was. I had the top down, the glistening sun was picking the edges off the surf out in the ocean and turning it into a slippery silver. Dudes on surfboards lounged around waiting for the one, which never came. I knew exactly how they felt. Then, my phone rang. It was Natasha. She had fallen for me after one of these dates, so she had to go. That's the rule, Maddie. That's the rule. But somehow, even though I jettisoned her, she was still a friend. "Hey, Maddie," she said in her inimitably sunny way. She was as bright as the sun on the ocean, always. Sometimes I had to look away just to get my bearings back. "Hey, Natasha, how are you?" I said. It was so lovely to hear from her. "What's going on with you?" Perhaps if she was calling me, there was a chance that we could... "I'm a mother," she announced. "I just had a baby girl, Clover." "Oh," I said, then quickly recovered, or thought I did. "That's fantastic news, babe. I love that name, too." We talked for a little while, and then we got off the phone. And then, out of nowhere, the fuck you everybody car was pulling over. Because I was pulling it over. And I lurched to a stop on the verge. The sun was still high. The surfers were up on their boards. But I was utterly thunderstruck with emotion. This giant wave everyone was looking for was happening in my head. "She could have had that child with me," I said to no one, as I sobbed like a newborn myself. I was so sad and alone. I cried for about 45 minutes until, gradually, a new thought came, like clouds across the sky above an ocean. Jesus, this is quite a reaction. It behooved me to work out why I'd broken down so hard. I sat there, wondering and wondering, until I finally realized what the fuck I had been doing. I'd been looking for an hour or so of pleasure with every woman ever invented, when there was so much life I was missing. Is this why I got sober? To sleep with women? Surely God had something better in store for me than that. I would need to find out, and fast. Natasha's life was blossoming while mine was turning into one huge mistake. When I try to work out how sobriety and addiction work for me, I keep coming back to this line. I'm capable of staying sober unless anything happens. Some quiet days, when I was sober, I'd think back to the recent past and wonder why I'd ever picked up pills or drugs after getting clean. When I was sober, strong, and feeling like a normal person, I'd sometimes have a fantasy of putting on a baseball cap and shades and heading off to mingle with the regular people poking around the La Brea tar pits. Or standing next to some celebrity star on the Walk of Fame, just to see what it's like. Not in the sense of, I'm a star, I'm better than them, no. In the sense of, oh, this is what a sober life feels like. But I was still so often just a tourist in sobriety. It was so hard to put down roots in it. Why was it so hard for me when I'd seen hundreds around me do it with impunity? I was dating literally everyone and anyone in LA, but I'd also met a woman in New York I really liked. I was not faithful to her, but I loved her. I was newly sober and famous, and I wanted to fuck everybody in Los Angeles County. Many reciprocated my desires. My speech worked far more than it had the right to, but the woman I loved in New York was like a good mom. A great caretaker, so beautiful. So, of course, I was drawn to her. And, of course, I screwed it up. But it wasn't all bad. In LA, I was also working to help other alcoholics get sober, sponsoring people, answering calls whenever needed, imparting advice. Friends was a juggernaut, too, and I didn't have to worry about fucking that up. I was clean, and I was about to have my season. The one where everyone was talking about Chandler. 9 was the only year I was completely sober for a Friends season. Care to hazard a guess as to which was the one year I got nominated for an Emmy for Best Actor in a Comedy? Yep, season 9. If that doesn't tell you something, nothing will. What did I do so differently that season? I listened. I didn't just stand there and wait for my turn to speak. Sometimes in acting, it's more powerful to listen than to talk. I've tried to incorporate that in my real life, too. No more, say less. That's my new mantra. The 2 years flew by. Maybe this is what normal people feel. Maybe I'd found my calling. Beyond friends, beyond movie stardom, beyond everything, I was here to help people get and stay sober. And then something happened, and I'm capable of staying sober unless anything happens. One of the women I'd used the speech on had grown attached to me, and as we know, dear listener, if that happens, I have to backpedal. So that's what I did. I said, I don't love you. I warned you when I met you. Remember the speech when I asked you about the menu? But it was too late. Some kind of agony hook was in her. It was my fault. Is this why I got sober? To sleep with women and then to hurt them? Surely God had something better in store for me than that. She was staying at the Beverly Hills Hotel at the time, and I went to see her, but she could not be consoled. She reminded me of my mother. No matter how much charm I used, no matter which funny thing I said, I could not help her pain. Eventually, she stormed off into the bathroom, leaving me alone in the room. On the side table, there was a knocked-over bottle of Vicodin. 3 of the pills had spilled out under the glare of the bedside lamp. She was locked in the bathroom, screaming. I couldn't take care of the situation. This was the anything that was happening. So, I took 3 of the pills, and somehow made it through the night. But I had thereby ended 2 years of sobriety. I was in deep, deep shit again, because once you puncture the membrane of sobriety, the phenomenon of craving kicks in, and you're off to the races one more time. It was impossible for me to get back. I graduated quickly to getting my own pills, and then I was drinking again. I was knowingly surfing down a long slide to oblivion. But it was bigger than me. There was literally nothing I could do about it. Looking back, all I would have had to do was tell someone about it. But that would mean I would have to stop. But stopping was not an option. At one point in 1999, I was sitting alone in my way too big house at the top of Carla Ridge, yet another house with a beautiful view, this time of the Los Angeles Basin. Down there, somewhere, normal Los Angeles life was going on. Tar Pits, Walk of Fame. Up here, I was just waiting it out, drink in one hand, steady flow of Marlboro Lights in the other. We were 5 seasons into Friends. Ross and Rachel had just stumbled out of a chapel, married, ahead of Chandler and Monica. Friends was a cultural touchstone, a shorthand for the millennium, the number one show on the planet, everyone's favorite watch. And that way of speaking, could this be any hotter, had swept the nation. Now everyone was talking that way. Clinton was in the White House. The date September 11th meant nothing special unless it was your birthday or your wedding anniversary. All the water in the world was flowing downhill into a sparkling lake upon which the most beautiful, nameless birds endlessly floated. Now a messenger was at my door, interrupting my reverie. It was as if I was reenacting what had happened to the romantic poet Coleridge, who had been interrupted from his own buzz. He got his via opium, by the legendary person from Porlock. At the time, Coleridge had the entirety of his poem Kubla Khan memorized in his opiate-addled mind. But the messenger who had arrived at his door that day in 1797 had shattered that memory, leaving only 54 lines for posterity. I was no Coleridge, but my buzz had been notable all the same. The view and the vodka tonic and the sweet Marlboro burn had rendered me into a safe place, where I was no longer unaccompanied, where somehow, back there in the house behind me, a beautiful wife, a gaggle of amazing kids were tumbling around in a playroom while Daddy had some quality time alone in the screening room. You want to feel lonely? Watch a movie alone in the screening room. It was at times like these, when the haze was deepest, that I could imagine my life was not filled with holes, that the minefield that was my past had been metal detected by men in hazard suits into a benign and beautiful safety. But now my doorbell was buzzing, killing my buzz, and because there was no wife, no kids, it was up to me to reluctantly answer it. The person from Porlock handed me a package, inside of which was a script entitled The Whole Nine Yards, and my manager had written on it, "Could be pay dirt." It was no Kubla Khan, but I could see it was going to be huge. I was always bad at reading scripts. Back then, I'd be offered millions of dollars to do movies and barely crack the first few pages. I'm embarrassed to admit that now, given that these days I'm writing scripts myself, and it's like pulling teeth to get actors to respond. Maybe they feel how I used to feel, that in a life of fun and fame and money, reading a script, no matter the size of the number attached, feels all too much like school. The universe will teach you, though. All those years I was too this, too that, to read a script. But last year I wrote a screenplay for myself and was trying to get it made until I realized that I was too old to play the part. Most 53-year-olds had worked their own shit out already, so I needed to hire a 30-year-old. The one I chose took weeks and weeks to respond. I couldn't believe how rude his behavior was. "Do I still have enough juice to get an independent movie made?" I asked my manager, Doug, in frustration. "Not really," Doug said. But back then, in 1999, my person from Porlock had brought me a script that even I could see had potential, and that potential was that none other than Bruce Willis was attached. At the turn of the century, there was no bigger movie star than Bruce Willis. He'd already banked Look Who's Talking and its sequel, the Die Hard franchise, Pulp Fiction. There was no one more successful back then. Not to mention that it would be a welcome relief from the 72 romantic comedies I'd just completed. Mitchell Kapner had written a funny script filled with twists and turns, and it was easy to read, always a good sign. Best of all, Bruce Willis was in it, and I played the lead character. Show me an acclaimed and successful TV star, and I will show you a frustrated wannabe movie star. Pay dirt? You bet your ass. But first, I had to get through a dinner with the director and my co-star's brother. I showed up the next night at Citrus on Melrose. Back then, this was the Hollywood restaurant. Expensive, exclusive, jacket required, and a line of paparazzi at the door clicking away madly at everyone who came and went. That night, the comings and goings were me. The film's director, Jonathan Lynn, a short, round British man who'd made My Cousin Vinny, and who just happened to be Oliver Sacks' cousin, and one of the film's producers, Bruce's brother, David. David got the hair, by the way, Bruce got the chin. I had donned the requisite movie star black suit for the dinner. I'd arrived a minute or two late, just because that's what movie stars do. The dinner went really well, even if no one touched their food, in the standard Hollywood way. Jonathan was very smart and funny. He had that dry, British approach to humor, in which he'd say something that was seemingly serious, but there would be a twinkle in his eye, just enough to signal that he was busting balls. David was attentive and interesting and smart. As for me, well, I had already decided to do the movie. The original script had no physical comedy in it, so I said things like, I think this would be a great opportunity for some physical comedy, and I'd be more than willing to fall down a flight of stairs and leap down some mountaintops to work with Bruce Willis. Jonathan and David laughed and seemed relieved. Eventually, the dinner wrapped up. Jonathan said, well, you're our guy. We really want you to do this. Hand shaken, paparazzi ignored, I jumped into my forest green Porsche and squealed away. I'm going to be the lead in a Bruce Willis movie, I thought, as again all the lights on Sunset were green. Back at my house on Carla Ridge, the moon had come up, lonely, mournful, casting a strange and awkward shadow across my view. I put on the TV, poured a vodka tonic, and waited. The stars were lining up again. Had the rise and rise of Matthew Perry just taken yet another giant leap forward? This is what I thought as the actual stars rose in a clear, dark sky. I started to count them, even though I knew the superstition that once you reach 100, you die. I stopped at 99, just in case. The following morning, I got a message on my answering machine. Matthew, this is Bruce Willis. Call me back or I'll burn your house down and break both your knees and arms and you'll be left with just stubs for hands and feet for the rest of your life. Click, dial tone. I figured this was a call I should probably return. A few days later, we met at Ago, yet another fancy Italian restaurant in Hollywood. In the private room in the back, the one that's reserved for people of Mr. Willis's status, once again, I jetted up in my Porsche, barely putting it in park long enough to hand the valet my keys. But this night, I was on time. Bruce Willis did not disappoint. He oozed A-list. He didn't just take over a room, he was the room. In fact, I knew he was a real movie star when the first thing he did was teach the bartender how to make a perfect vodka tonic. 3-second pour, he said to the petrified man. Bruce was 44 years old, single, separated from Demi Moore at the time I met him, and he knew the exact recipe for the perfect drink. He was a party. To be near him was invigorating. After a while, we were visited in our private little room by Joe Pesci, whom Jonathan Lynn had directed in My Cousin Vinny, as well as several attendant attractive women. Bruce laughed at all my dumb jokes. He seemed to enjoy the spectacle of a younger, funny guy paying him his due respect and keeping up with his drinking, if he only knew. I was thrilled to be around him because he knew how to live life. Dinner once again untouched, the two new best friends headed to his massive house off Mulholland. Bruce, too, seemed to like a view. The night ended with Bruce Willis and Matthew Perry, drinks in hand, hitting golf balls into the San Fernando Valley below. Those balls are gonna land somewhere, I thought, and before I could imagine the damage a shot from a well-addressed 5-iron could do, or even the metaphorical nature of what we were doing, I stopped thinking at all and had another drink. Welcome to the pros, Bruce said at one point. referring, I presume, to the life of a movie star, not my golf game. We had begun a friendship, one in which we drank together and made each other laugh and complimented each other's swings. Eventually, as always happens, the sun came up. We said our bleary goodbyes. As I drove home, I remember thinking, watch this guy. This is the way to be happy. Nothing seemed to bother Bruce. No one said no to him. This was indeed the A-Leagues. Around lunchtime that same day, Bruce called me to invite me back to his house for a screening of his next movie. But I was way too sick and hungover to even contemplate showing up. Making my excuses, I asked him what the movie was called so I could catch it later. The Sixth Sense, he said. So, I'd gotten the whole nine yards and embarked on a friendship with the most famous movie star on the planet. But even I knew I was drinking way too much to pull this movie off. Desperate measures would be needed. Some might be able to party perfectly well and still show up and do the work, but they were not addicts like I was. If I was going to keep up with the partying with Bruce and not go back to my hotel room and keep drinking, then I'd need something else to wind me down and make sure I could get to the set the next day. I called a friend, I use the term loosely, who I knew sold Xanax. How many would you like to purchase? He skeeved at me. Give me 100, I said. When they arrived, I sat on my bed counting them. This way, I can drink with Bruce and the others, but when I'm finally alone, I can just pop one of these and go to sleep. I may have been a man with a plan, but I was also ignoring the fact that this was a completely lethal combination. We flew on Bruce's plane, of course we did, to Montreal to make the whole nine yards, arriving like conquering heroes, ready to take the town by storm. I was the prodigal Canadian son, now returned, ready to party. We set up shop at the Intercontinental Hotel. I had a regular room, Bruce had the whole top floor, which he immediately dubbed Club Z for no apparent reason. Within hours, he had also had a disco ball installed. The Globe restaurant became our home away from home. The money and the drinks were flowing and the waitresses were hot. Months earlier, I had started dating a woman called Renee. I'd met her at a restaurant in Los Angeles called Red. I was having dinner with the first assistant director of Friends, my pal Ben Weiss, and our waitress came and sat down next to me and started chatting to me. This was not normal waitress behavior, it seemed to me. When she had taken our order, I said to Ben, her name is gonna be Samantha. Nah, he said, she's definitely a Jennifer. When she came back with our food, I said, we're having a bet on your name. I have money on Sam, and my friend here thinks you're a Jen. Hi, she said, I'm Renee. And somehow, a few drunken parties later, we were a couple. Suffice to say, Renee had substituted for someone who'd broken my heart on an earlier movie, which put her already behind the eight ball. By the time I went to Montreal, we were mostly on the outs, but in any case, and I'm not proud to say this, I would have fucked mud at that stage in my life. Canadian mud, at that. The role itself was a snap. All I had to do was act scared of Bruce, which was easy, and act in love with Natasha Henstridge, which was even easier. The director Jonathan, whom for some unknown reason I had taken to calling Sammy, ran that kind of set I love, a very creative one. The best joke, no matter where it came from, would be picked, just like we did on Friends. Amanda Peet was also in the cast. She was funny and smart and very attractive. And even though she had a boyfriend, she didn't mind flirting, which she did at the drop of a hat with both Bruce and me, to the point where one day Bruce shouted at her, "Pick one!" At night, the parties raged under Bruce's disco ball in Club Z. Somehow, everyone managed to still show up at 6 a.m. for work. I would say somehow, but I know how I did. Those 100 Xanax worked like a charm. Though combined with my drinking, they did tend to make my head resemble a Spalding basketball. Meanwhile, Mr. A-List Willis over there looked like he can open an envelope with his chin. Each day, with me nursing a killer hangover but young enough to deal, we would gather and look at the sides, TV and movie speak for the work slated for the day. We was me, Jonathan Lynn, Bruce Willis, and the hilarious Kevin Pollak, who was playing Yanni Gogolak, another mob boss. It was almost like a writer's room. We'd discuss what might be funny, what might go here in a scene, what might go there. A lot of effort was to add physical comedy for me to do. I would run into windows, slam into doors. At one point, I did a take in which I see a criminal, then turn, run into someone, get knocked back, clatter into a lamp, pick the lamp up, and try to shield myself from the baddie with it. All my idea, all worked great. At one point, Kevin had the line, he shouldn't be able to breathe the air. I suggested to him that he insert an unnaturally long pause before the words, the air. That was about the only time in my career where I could not keep it together. Kevin's performance of that line was so funny, and the pause kept getting longer and longer with each take we did, that in the end, we had to do his coverage with me in a different room. When the veil of Bruce Willis was removed, I just wanted to be his friend. I didn't want to be a suck-up to him like everybody else in the world. At one point, when making the whole nine yards, we had a three-day weekend, and he flew me and Renee and him and his girlfriend to his house in the Turks and Caicos. It's a beautiful place with a stunning view of the ocean. They'd even thought to buy out all the surrounding properties so the paparazzi couldn't get their shots. All weekend, we carried umbrellas with us to block us from the sun so that our faces wouldn't get too tanned and not match for the movie. A new movie star trick, one of many I learned from Mr. Willis. But there was a big difference between Bruce and me. Bruce was a partier. I was an addict. Bruce has an on and off button. He can party like crazy, then get a script like The Sixth Sense and stop the partying and nail the movie sober. He doesn't have the gene. He's not an addict. There are plenty of examples of people in Hollywood who can party and still function. I was not one of them. When I was in my drinking and using days, if a police officer were to come to the door and say, "If you drink tonight, you're going to jail tomorrow," I would start packing for jail, because once I start, I cannot stop. All I had control over was the first drink. After that, all bets were off. See under, the man takes the drink takes all the rest. Once I believe the lie that I can just have one drink, I am no longer responsible for my actions. I need people and treatment centers and hospitals and nurses to help me. I can't stop. And if I didn't get a hold of this soon, it was going to kill me. I had a monster in my brain, a monster who wanted to get me alone and convince me to have the first drink or pill. And then that monster would engulf me. Despite the partying, we were all pros on that movie and managed to turn out a huge crowd pleaser. Early notices for it were positive. One, in Variety magazine, read, "Bruce Willis will deliver the customers, but it's Matthew Perry who will attract the most attention in a pratfall-filled turn that bears comparison to what Tom Hanks was doing 12 to 15 years ago." This was high praise indeed for someone who looked up to Tom. Bruce hadn't been sure the film would work at all, and I'd bet him it would. If he lost, he had to do a guest spot on Friends. He's in 3 episodes of season 6. The whole nine yards became the number one movie in America for 3 weeks straight. I had done it. The dream I'd had since the 9th grade had finally come true. The whole nine yards was no Back to the Future, but Michael J. Fox and I are the only two people who have had the number one movie and the number one TV show at the same time. I should have been the toast of the town, but back in L.A., it was clear, at least to me, that my addiction had progressed to dangerous levels. I was at the point where I basically was unable to leave my house. Drugs and alcohol had completely taken over. I was so strung out on drugs and dealing with drug dealers that I couldn't even leave my bedroom. Instead of a grand moment of pure fame, dealing with the dealers was all I was doing. I showed up to the premiere of the movie, of course, and put on the Matthew Perry show, but I was bloated and driven by fear of something I did not understand. I've always had a dream of going on a talk show and being honest. Jay Leno. So how you doing, Matthew? Me. Man, I just don't know which way is up. I'm totally screwed. I'm so miserable. I can't get out of bed. This would have been the perfect time for that. 4 years after the whole nine yards, Bruce and I and Kevin shot a sequel, different director this time. If the whole nine yards was the start of my movie stardom, it's fair to say that the whole 10 yards was the end. We shot the second movie in Los Angeles. We were given all too much freedom, and it sucked. You can seldom recreate a good thing, and it was true here. The jokes felt stale, the parties even staler. In fact, it was so bad that a while later I called my agents and said, "I'm still allowed to go to movies, though, right?" When The Whole Nine Yards came out, I had been so mired in addiction I could barely leave my room. I had been in a hellhole of despair and demoralization, and my fucked-up mind was slowly dragging my body down with it. Recently, it struck me, this type of feeling should have been reserved for when The Whole 10 Yards came out. Anyone in their right mind would have been beyond depressed after that one. Sometimes, at the end of the night, when the sun was just about to come up and everyone else had gone and the party was over, Bruce and I would just sit and talk. That's when I saw the real Bruce Willis. A good-hearted man, a caring man, selfless, a wonderful parent, and a wonderful actor. And most important, a good guy. And if he wanted me to be, I would be his friend for life. But as is the way with so many of these things, our paths rarely crossed after that. I, of course, pray for him every night now. Interlude. All heaven breaking loose. Something happened, and I relapsed. As I've said, to relapse, that's all it takes. Something, anything at all happening, good or bad. I was blowing yet another stretch of sobriety. I don't even remember why. I'd been thriving. I'd had 2 years. I was helping other men get sober, and I blew it over something so minute I can't even remember what it was. What I do remember is there was lots of drinking, lots of drugs, lots of isolation. I always used alone. I was afraid that if anybody saw how much I was doing, they would be horrified and try to get me to stop. But I had already started, so stopping was not an option. Something that has often saved my life is that I get scared. When I think things have gotten too out of control, I panic, pick up the phone, and ask for help. That time, a sober companion and my wonderful father came to the rescue. They moved in immediately. I started to detox off the drugs that very day. I felt physically completely ruined, but the detox was going well. At least, that's what my dad and sober companion thought. What they didn't know was I had hidden a bottle of Xanax in my bedroom. This is what it's like to be an addict. You do things you never dreamed you'd do. My wonderful father had dropped everything to move in, to love and support me through one more self-created disaster, and I paid him back by hiding drugs in my nightstand? One night, I was so desperate for sleep, any kind of escape from the brutal detox I was going through. That bottle of Xanax was calling to me, an evil beacon in the darkness. I thought of it like a lighthouse, only in this case, I turned my boat toward the wrecking rocks, not away from them. The childproof bottle cap was no obstacle for this child. In the other room, that child's father dozed, watching reruns of Taxi, while in my room, by the metaphorical lethal cliffs, I dove into that bottle of Xanax and took four. One was too many, but four? It didn't work. No escape came. Those four Xanax proved no match for my racing thoughts. Sleep remained elusive. It was being held back by shame and fear and intense self-loathing. So, what's the next logical move? Well, for this drug addict, it was to take four more. This wasn't just eight too many. This was a death-defying amount. Somehow, these second four combined with the first four, and I finally managed to fall asleep. The sleep on Xanax isn't profound. The drug is notoriously shit at providing deep sleep. But I didn't care. I just wanted this brain of mine, this thing that stalked me, to quieten just for a few hours at least, and some relief from the incredibly painful detox I was going through. I was fortunate enough to wake up, but the Xanax had done something worse than preventing deep sleep. It had fried my brain and made me insane. I was seeing things, strange visions and colors I'd never seen before. Colors I didn't even know existed. The gray automated drapes in my bedroom had turned into a deep purple color. It was as if the rods and cones in my retina were sending new unbidden messages through my optic nerve to my already barbecued brainstem. Regular blues were cerulean now. Reds were magentas, black was Vanta Black, or Black 3.0, the blackest of blacks. Not only that, but I had run out of Xanax, and if something was not done quickly about that, I could die. Remember, booze and Xanax are the only detoxes that can kill you. An opiate detox just makes you wish you were dead. But I was coming off all of them. My only option was to somehow get more Xanax. But the setup in my house didn't allow for that. I would surely get caught. So I would have to come clean about the fact that I had been taking it so I could get properly detoxed from it, too. I left my bedroom and into a kaleidoscope of color of my living room. Is this heaven? I thought. Did the Xanax kill me last night and this is what heaven is like? I gently explained to my dad and the sober companion what I had done. They were both appropriately terrified. The sober companion leapt into action and called a doctor. I was completely out of my mind. It was then that I decided to share with my father a fear I was having. "Dad," I said, deadly serious, "I know this is going to sound crazy, but at any moment, a giant snake is going to come and take me away." My father's reaction? "Maddie, if a giant snake comes and takes you away, I will shit my pants." To this day, I was impressed by how my father rolled with my utter insanity. At this point, the sober companion returned to the room, expressed his disappointment, but said he was still willing to help me out. But I needed to see a doctor right away. We headed off to see him. At the end of the consultation, I apologized to the doctor, shook his hand, and promised it would never happen again. And I meant it. I was done. The doctor ordered new detox meds, anti-seizure medication. Detoxing from Xanax can cause seizures. We headed home. My long-suffering assistant, Moira, was called to pick up said medication, and we waited. And waited. For some reason, it took her hours to complete this new mission. The clock was ticking, though. If I didn't get this detox medication soon, some serious shit was going to go down. I could have a seizure, I could die. Neither option sounded good to me. Now three grown men were staring at the front door, waiting for it to open. And two of these men were also staring at a scared Maddie. After a while, I couldn't bear the scrutiny and removed myself to a small couch to the side of the kitchen. Reality, that acquired taste, was beginning to reassert itself, slowly, surely, like a lens focusing. and I felt absolutely horrible, both physically and emotionally. I was riddled with shame and guilt. I could not believe I had done this one more time. The men I was sponsoring had more sober time than I did. You can't give away what you don't have, and I had nothing. I hated myself. This was a new bottom. I didn't think you could get any lower than my previous bottom, but I had managed to do it. And all of this in front of my father, who was obviously terrified. The cunning, baffling, powerful nature of addiction had gotten me one more time. The front door still wasn't opening. This was serious trouble. I was a desperate man. The drugs were in full flow, the drinking too. Things were so bad I couldn't even cry. To cry might have signaled that there was at least a semblance of the normal somewhere about. But there was nothing natural about any of this. So, a bottom. The lowest point in my life. This is a classic moment for an addict. A moment after which one seeks lasting help. But hey, what's this now? As I sat there looking into the kitchen, I noticed a crinkle in the atmosphere. Perhaps someone not at their bottom might have waved it away as nothing, but to me it was so compelling that I couldn't look away. It resembled a kind of little wave in the air. I'd never seen anything like it before in my life. It was real, true, tangible, concrete. Is this what you see at the end? Was I dying? And then I frantically began to pray, with the desperation of a drowning man. The last time I prayed, right before I got in friends, I'd managed only to strike a Faustian bargain with God, who had simply drawn a long breath and bided his damn time. Here I was, more than a decade later, chancing my praying arm once again. God, please help me, I whispered. Show me that you're here. God, please help me. As I prayed, the little wave in the air transformed into a small golden light. As I knelt, the light slowly began to get bigger and bigger until it was so big that it encompassed the entire room. It was like I was standing on the sun. I had stepped on the surface of the sun. What was happening? And why was I starting to feel better? And why was I not terrified? The light had engendered a feeling more perfect than the most perfect quantity of drugs I had ever taken. Feeling euphoric now, I did get scared and tried to shake it off, but there was no shaking this off. He was way bigger than me. My only choice was to surrender to it, which was not hard because it felt so good. The euphoria had begun at the top of my head and slowly seeped down throughout my entire body. I must have sat there for 5, 6, 7 minutes filled with it. My blood hadn't been replaced with warm honey. I was warm honey. And for the first time in my life, I was in the presence of love and acceptance and filled with an overwhelming feeling that everything was going to be okay. I knew now that my prayer had been answered. I was in the presence of God. Bill Wilson, who created AA, was saved by a lightning bolt through the window experience where he felt he was meeting God. This was mine. But feeling this good was terrifying. I was once asked if I'd ever been happy, and I almost bit that fucker's head off. At Promises once during a rehab, I told my counselor that I was freaked out by how happy everyone recovering seemed. They're like a bunch of happy people living on a hill while I'm dying, I'd said, and he explained to me that a lot of those people weren't getting it and didn't understand what was going on and would eventually be back in rehab, and things would be even worse for them next time. After about 7 minutes, insert 7 minutes in heaven joke here, the light began to dim. The euphoria died down. God had done his work and was off helping someone else now. I started to cry. I mean, really started to cry. That shoulder-shaking kind of uncontrollable weeping. I wasn't crying because I felt sad. I was crying because for the first time in my life, I felt okay. I felt safe, taken care of. Decades of struggling with God and wrestling with life and sadness, all was being washed away, like a river of pain gone into oblivion. I had been in the presence of God. I was certain of it. And this time, I had prayed for the right thing. Help. Eventually, the weeping subsided, but everything was different now. I could see color differently. Angles were of a different magnitude. The walls were stronger, the ceiling higher. The trees tapping on the windows were more perfect than ever. Their roots connected via the soil to the planet and back into me. One great connection created by an ever-loving God. And beyond, a sky which had been theoretically infinite was now unknowably endless. I was connected to the universe in a way I'd never been before. Even the plants in my house, which I had never even noticed before, seemed in sharp focus, more lovely than it was possible to be, more perfect, more alive. I stayed sober for 2 years based solely on that moment. God had shown me a sliver of what life could be. He had saved me that day, and for all days, no matter what. He had turned me into a seeker, not only of sobriety and truth, but also of Him. He had opened a window and closed it as if to say, "Now go earn this." Nowadays, when a particular darkness hits me, I find myself wondering if it was just Xanax insanity, a continuation of the snake I had been sure was about to show up. The drug can cause what the National Institutes of Health described as reversible brief psychotic episodes. I later had a gigantic seizure in front of my father, too, which wasn't the most fun I've ever had, nor was being rushed to UCLA Medical Center, which at the time I thought was an angel way station. But quickly I returned to the truth of the golden light. When I'm sober, I can still see it. Remember what it did for me. Some might write it off as a near-death experience, but I was there, and it was God. And when I'm connected, God shows me that it was real. Little hints like when the sunlight hits the ocean and turns into that beautiful golden color. Or the reflection of the sunlight on the green leaves of a tree. Or when I see the light return to somebody's eyes when they come out of the darkness into sobriety. And I feel it when I help someone get sober. The way it hits my heart when they say thank you. Because they don't know yet that I should really be thanking them. A year later, I met a woman I'd stay with for 6 years. God is everywhere. You just have to clear your channel, or you'll miss it.